You are listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between at horticulture.com. I'm Jason Horsley. I'm talking this week to Ashley, a family member, about experiences with Dave O'Shana and other stuff. Chest. Working on this blog, because initially he'd announced the meeting as about as he'd mentioned something about full-on spiritual warfare, and I thought, ooh, and so I included that in my blog thing. But then when I went to look, I saw the current description or the last one doesn't have anything like that. So I had to go all the way back to the first email he sent out, and it was a completely different description of the event, same title, and much more sort of dark and apocalyptic, which is a side point, really. I think I have noticed how he starts with stuff that's more kind of dramatic and therefore gets my attention anyway, probably other people's too. It might be off-putting to other people, but not to me. But then by the time it's actually finalized, it's much softer and it's vaguer, lighter. But as a more general thing, the fact that he's even between first announcing the event and a day before, whatever, when it's even in those few days, it keeps changing the way he's describing it. And then, of course, he shows up and he says, "I don't know if I'm going to talk about any of this." So, I mean, that is obviously that is different. It's more. Well, it's different. I don't know if it's more extreme, but it's not so much the identity of being a psychotherapist, but actually describing what you're going to talk about. Obviously, as you can see, how that obviously very much shut things down, just as if you agreed with a client that you were going to talk about this or that issue before you even got in the room. It would be, it would close the space down, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But then on top of that is the thing of the identity, which he or you or I, for that matter, can't fully shed, because anyone who comes to any of us, in your case, if you're as a psychotherapist, they're coming because of that. And that's what made them aware of you. And of course, he's addressing this with me. I mean, the thing that he talked about yesterday, you probably guessed that he was talking about me, the conversation he was having with me. Did you guess that? About self-sabotage?
I don't know if I can remember that. I'm having this real problem with remembering what people say in that kind of context. There's so much. Do I remember that? Say a bit more and maybe I will.
He was saying he was talking to this person about self-sabotage and how they could reach more people with their work. And he was a central thing he was talking about yesterday about the dirty old men in Macintosh.
Oh, yeah, I remember
based
that.
Based on the exchanges that he's been having with me since the campaign, but prior to that as well, about how I could reach a wider audience and how I was self-sabotaging, and specifically around the kind of people that are drawn to my work and then give me feedback, and because he was talking all about how we get influenced by other people's words and this whole thing of, I mean, that example he gave of his aunt I thought was very useful, as in his aunt would say, "You're a good boy, go to the shops for me." Well, you can see how that works. Also, if I or you or Dave do something and people like it, they say, "That's really good, give me some more," right? And so then you get locked into that. You take on the identification or the tag of good, I'm good at this, therefore I'll keep doing it. It makes you very easy to manipulate.
Yeah, and the attention you get as well. That's what happened to me. That's how I became a carer, because Mum was nice to me when I looked, I used to change your nappy, let her off the hook. She was relieved. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yesterday I found myself, I mean, obviously I've got resistances, resistance, whatever the right way of putting it is. And I noticed that the most, well, maybe last year when I went to the thing in London that he did, but what then perhaps came back a bit, not a lot, because I feel all this trust and warmth towards him these days, but there was something yesterday for me about how I completely understood. I mean, he may well be very different than he was 12 years ago, whenever it was that you met him, but what I felt was, oh, no wonder Jason said, are you really enlightened? Because that's what I was feeling or thinking or whatever. He sounded so normal, just like a bloke that was trying to catch his dog and stop his dog from running, and they got kind of annoyed or something. And, you know, I was like, well, do we know that you're enlightened? This is what Jason always used to say. So that's really interesting for me because it's, you know, it's part of the whole experience for me. I can't just apparently go, oh, Dave, I've arrived. Thank God I've arrived. I mean, I do feel that, but I can't feel it, whatever the word is, without interruption or without limitations. Not that I felt resentful when I was having those thoughts. I was feeling interested, actually. Oh, that's so interesting, because you just seem like a bloke.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that he just seems like a bloke, that doesn't seem like enlightened. So then there's a certain frame that you've got already, mm-hmm. even though you've never met anyone else who's enlightened and you haven't really studied enlightenment.
I know.
It's interesting.
And I don't believe it, really. I just go into those defensive places, you see. And I don't know, presumably he definitely does it his way, because that's what he does. And so, and maybe he probably experiences that a lot. People going, well, you don't seem very enlightened. You did it, didn't you? So he must be very, very used to it, and he perpetuates it, arguably, possibly, I don't know.
I think so. I mean, there's a few things that came out yesterday. One was very specific that he said about how, and he said this before, you know, people seeing the lights around him and all this phenomena. He's mentioned that how he didn't talk about that.
Yeah.
So that's a clue.
With an Italian man.
Also, I noticed yesterday how he talked about, I can't remember how he got to the point, but he was saying, and then you experience yourself. With everything or existence, being aware of all of existence, that's right. And he said that he doesn't have that experience because all he experiences is existence.
Mm.
And it was just a quick qualifier before he carried on his other point. Right? He's saying that at a certain point you become aware of all of existence, and that would be your experience. But then he just added in, "What? That's not my experience, because all I experience is existence." Right? So little things like that. They're not big. He's not making a big claim. He's just making a qualifier to you know, like a footnote. Like, I'm describing something to you that you may experience, but actually this is what I'm experiencing. And then what he's indicating is that he doesn't experience himself as existing separate from existence. Well, okay, so that could be a huge claim
of enlightenment.
Yes, if somebody wanted a definition of enlightenment, they could go into that and make a big claim of it. But it's much more persuasive when it's just there as a footnote to just disqualify something he's saying.
Yeah, like, by the way, or in black brackets, or...
And but the main thing that I found is a constant reminder that Dave is in a different state, time. I mean, there are obviously, there's no end to them because of his way of being and his joy and his level of energy and these things. But I mean, in terms of enlightenment as some goal that seems almost beyond comprehension, let's say, which was always my, I mean, that's everybody's context for it. And anyone, you say the word enlightenment, if it means anything, it's some ultimate goal that's beyond our comprehension, right? Even people who are not interested in it and say it doesn't exist, it's kind of like God or something. So in my initial, when I first met him, I had this idea of enlightenment that was quite specific, that involved, you know, being aware of everything going on in the universe all of the time and so on and so forth. So he didn't meet the criteria of that because he just didn't seem to be overflowing with cosmic knowledge, let's say. But when he talks about, for example, how he can talk to people and he touches different parts of their bodies, or when he talks about, when he mentions how he could tune, he was tuning into the group and he noticed that some people, their energy wasn't going into their hips on the left and the right side, that's when I have an experience of, oh my God, you know, I don't even know what kind of perceptual experience Dave is having, or you know, how I could ever possibly partake of something like that.
Yeah.
So they tend to be things that are incomprehensible, but not in some big, epic, cosmic way. One could imagine that animals, that's why it's interesting he brings up his dog so much, we could imagine that animals pick up these sorts of things.
Yeah.
They notice somehow by smell or by temperature or whatever, that where the life force is distributed in the bodies of each other, and I mean, or babies even, or infants, or children, or things that are just really innate. But the thing about him not anymore being an ordinary bloke or not having ordinary feelings to her, I found is definitely a red herring. Or I mean, it's a dangerous red herring, actually, because even if in some sense it's true, I don't know if it is or not, if in some sense Dave is wearing, or Dave is just a costume that this life force puts on to interact with us, still that costume reacts like a sentient thing. That's how it works. So you can still hurt the feelings of the persona, even if...
Yeah, I was just thinking that word persona, yeah,
the
exactly.
The soul isn't identified with what the persona is experiencing. You're still hurting the feelings of the persona.
Yeah.
So it's still going to respond. And not as I say, respond rather than react, because I haven't really seen Dave be reactive.
Is that when you blushed?
Well, I was going to use that example. I mean, why is a blush a reaction and not a response? That's an assumption that is neurotic.
Yeah, because it comes from the body, doesn't it? The blushing, not the brain. Not the feelings are from the brain exactly, are they?
If it started to stammer and lose his cool and then cover it up and be defensive, you know, and get into all kinds of reactions, but just a, it's very strange, because it seems to be just that Dave has all the human responses that we often associate, some of them we would associate with neurosis because they seem like to be on the same spectrum, but the only ones I've seen him have, more or less, are benign. Like he seems to only have human responses or reactions that are benign, like blushing, that are sweet and touching. I mean, I'd say that because he can definitely be abrasive, but that I don't see that as a reactive thing. Like I haven't seen him be kind of harsh or abrasive in a defensive way or a,
it's just kind of a tactic.
Or just part of his personality. I mean, he's a rough East End lad, right?
That's true, yeah.
So there's a coarseness to him.
Yeah, my fantasy, I mean, or... is that the right word? I guess it's part fantasy, part kind of... moving slightly into something that was, well, it was definitely different for me. So it was a real experience. Well, I didn't just make it up, but I guess part of it was fantasy. So it's so interesting. And I would or will tell Dave if it comes up, or you can tell him through this. The thing I wrote to you about dancing last Friday, and feeling this, what I afterwards thought was transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went out to work and I spent the whole day wondering if, I mean, I knew, which is going to sound so stupid, so I'll preface it by saying I didn't know really that it was very, very likely to be untrue, but I was wondering if, am I enlightened? Because I felt so different. Like everything felt manageable and I was going to this really hard work and hard job. And I felt so different. And then this is amazing. And then Linda asked me, she'd asked me in the morning before I had the dancing experience, if I would go and visit this man. I don't think I told you much detail, but I couldn't bear it in there. When I went with her the first time, I could not bear it. It was so frightening. And she asked me if I would go that day because the carer had called in sick, and I ignored the message for about half an hour. And then I thought, do it for Linda, because you know you love her, and she has to step in over and over again. She has to step in when people, you know, bottle out or lie about being ill or whatever it is that was going on. I don't know the details. So I said, all right, I'll do it for you. But I must have done it because I felt, well, maybe you can do this, actually, just go and find out. And then I had the whole feeling of, you know, this is different. I'm going to be okay going to see him. I kind of know I am. And I went in and he was up. He wasn't on his bed with his eyes closed, his belly hanging out everywhere, and this squalor. He was actually wandering about and he made eye contact with me. And I helped him with a chore, and he had some sense of humour, and it was all about 10-15 minutes or something, but I did it, and it was okay, because I felt there was contact. I mean, probably not really connection, but maybe it was, I don't know, because it was a little bit of eye contact. He made a joke about... about my ineptitude around the microwave, which was funny because I am inept around microwaves. But I figured it out. And so we made a joke between us about how my brain wasn't completely dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then he wanted me to leave because he wanted to hunch over his own food in the plastic thing and not have me there and in his boxer shorts. So I left. But I felt, oh my God, that was okay. I can do this. I told Linda, you know what, if you want me to do him, to visit him, I will. Because something happened there. Something was different. And I was thinking about it and I was feeling so good about it. And the next day I was writing to Emerald, writing back to her letters, and I told her about this experience. And I finished telling it. I hadn't told her that I wondered if I was embodying any transmission. I hadn't told her that part of the story, just that, well, look what happened with me and Roy, because I told her about Roy. And then I checked my phone for some reason, pausing in the letter or something, and I checked my phone, and this text had come through the group, the caring, the carers group chat. It comes through, said, I've just visited Roy this morning, and he's cheerful and friendly, and what's happened to him? Wow. And I know, I'm not saying that it was me that did it, because that would be very presumptuous, but what if I was holding some transmission or something, because that's how it felt, and I went in and something happened that gave him something.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So it took me, when did I realize? Saturday, I think. I think I spent the whole day feeling that way, but by Saturday, it was gone.
Just like anything to sing, to sing, to sing, as a state of mind. Sunlight dances slowly on a drumbeat's broken rhyme. I speak in answers only to see them in my mind. If I had a penny, I'd throw it in the sea to see if it would float away, grow a penny tree. I play full of rhythm to speak of what is said. I never think of singing to those who feel the same. The rain falls, see the color in my hair, hunt for golden porridge bowls, hear the paper tear. Just like anything to sing, to sing, to sing, as a state of mind. Death gives no reason, so why should I? Death has no season, so I know I'll never die. Just like anything to sing, to sing, to sing, as a state of mind.
Right. Well, what do you think? Do you have any sense of how it went?
How it went away?
Yeah.
I mean, I was very good at responding to it. I mean, I'm very interested and pleased that I can, you know, develop some resources or find some ways. So what happened on Saturday morning, so I woke up feeling really gloomy and really sad. And I presumably it was dreams. I don't remember. I had a nightmare last night, by the way. And I lay in bed and I felt ill. I woke up also with a headache. And all I could feel like was staying in bed, not getting up, and that was. I felt so scared because this is the kind of context or the narrative, is I feel tired so much. But when I'm talking to you or dancing or even going out amongst the trees, I don't feel tired. So it must be something about what's happening internally. but I feel it so much. And I woke up, and I wake up feeling tired, and I have had a headache. And so I started to feel scared. What if you're ill? What if this is what, you know, there's something really sinister going on in your body? And presumably I was coming awake from the nightmare, whatever it was. And then I thought, come on, shower, eat, dance, write, see what happens. Go on. So I got up and I showered, I ate, I wrote something, I danced, I wrote some more, and I felt really different. Not back to where I'd been on Friday, but not in that same place of fear and I don't know, I wanted to say despair. Was it despair? It was certainly approaching despair. So I don't know.
Do you remember how you felt when you went to sleep though that night? Like, was it?
When I went to sleep on Friday night?
Yeah.
I was... because I put Emerald's letters off because I wanted to read them. And I thought, well, I'll save them till the morning. So I've got a really exciting start to the day. So I was doing something else online. Was it your stuff? I think maybe I was exploring the... when did I write the comments and all that?
Oh, the comments that got spammed.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't that Friday night?
1st of May.
Yeah, that's Friday.
4 p.m.
So midnight.
4 p.m. for me. So it would be 8 hours later for you, yeah. So it would be the... Friday was the first, but it was Friday, yeah, Friday night, Saturday morning. Actually, it was after midnight, it seems like.
Yeah, so technically, but that's the night I went to bed.
Obviously. Okay, so we were posting about Giles dying and all those men dying. So they, obviously that's going on.
There you go, and I've forgotten that. It's not very clever of me, is it? Because I was really engaged. I wasn't unhappy on the conscious level, because I was so engaged in what you're doing and how I got involved, and you know.
So I mean, something's coming to mind here, which is that he brought up yesterday. It was about, and he spoke about it for quite a while. Was about, and I'm not going to be able to paraphrase, but hopefully you'll remember. It was about people in spiritual groups, partly or large. Oh yeah, because it was about, you know, there's certain people in the group, not in, he didn't say in this group now, but he said in the past, so possibly now also, come for good feelings, to get good feelings. And then there was a lot more to it than that, but that's the condensed version. You remember that?
Yeah, I think so. It rings a bell. Weird how much I forget, isn't it?
So, because I mean, my first thought I had was, why I asked that series of questions was, I wonder if you, thinking that you're enlightened, or making that question, meant that your mind was becoming aware of that, and then kind of grabbing onto it. I wondered if that might have something to do with losing it, because that's been my experience. If I start to notice too much what's going on, I lose it.
Watch this.
Back as a kid, if I became aware I was happy, I became unhappy. So it's a pattern for me, but I think it's also to do with just a natural withdrawal of the life force if we start trying to put our hands on it. One of the components, or the main components in that, would be how much you might want to use those feelings to protect you from bad feelings, let's say.
Sure. I mean, because my bad feelings are pretty frightening. I mean, it's the fear that I'm not going to make it, and I'm going to have a bad death, and I'm going to be stranded in some dark limbo, maybe not as dark as Sebastian's, I'm sure, but you know, my own dark limbo alone. That's my terrible fear.
Mm-hmm. You had this transmission, you were holding some transmission, you shared it, so that's all good. And then, and of course, part of this was responding to my Maps of Hell campaign, because it was happening. I mean, I just launched it that day, or 24 hours before that, or something like that. Other thing was the 16th and Elvis. And so you were putting your attention on the men who died, as if maybe wanting to bring transmission to that, but also as if maybe that you felt strong enough to go there, perhaps. And then you went into sleep from that, and presumably went in deeper into those places. And then when you woke up, you were in the condition you were in. And another thought I had when you were describing that was, well, what if you had, because you described the things you did to get out of despair and feel different, and the thought I had, it won't surprise you, was what if you hadn't done that?
Mm-hmm.
What if you just said, okay, so I feel miserable and I will stay in bed? Because one of the things that Dave talked about over the years is about those first moments when we wake up and then we get up, and how our identity takes over, and then it takes us into the day. And so he's advised, you know, not letting that happen, just waiting what it takes till the life force gets us out of bed. And what you described there, I mean, because I have my own experience of that. And when you said waking up tired, I'm like, well, what other way is there to wake up? Because of my experience of that, I kind of lost that there, but. That's a coping mechanism that I have. Well, Sebastian had it too as well. I had to go swimming and jogging in the morning and all these things. And Valerie didn't do any of those things, but she also had the thing she never wanted to get up in the morning. She resented even getting dressed.
Yeah, she didn't like having a bath,
run though. Well, so we've all inherited that. Anyway, so but I was just.
Yeah. Okay. No, I mean, that's a really good place to try, or to venture, or to accept, or to whatever.
Well, I think the point I kind of was trying to get to was that the bad feelings may be not just a loss of the good things, but actually where you're able to go into, or what you're able to go into, because you've got that extra transmission. In a certain sense, maybe I just tweeted it, while it was in an email response to someone, and I thought, oh, that'll make a good tweet. Sometimes the worst hell is trying to stay out of hell. Because, if we do need to go into that stuff, the courage isn't the courage to pull ourselves out of it. The courage is to stay in it. It's sort of symbolic, it's a bit like you going to visit that old man. It's almost like a worldly enactment of that, isn't it? You're going into that place of hopelessness, bringing light into it.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest, most challenging parts of all of that is that the places I go to nowadays, not obviously in the past, but nowadays, the places I go to for relief from that, they're so healthy. Dancing and showering, I'd take that from what Dave said, because I didn't used to shower every morning. And eating healthily and writing with my left hand to my daughter, you know, these are all such healthy things for me, you know. So, but what I'm what I'm responding with right now when I say that is, well, yes, but it's not either or, is it? You know, you do it the other way or whatever, stay with that, see if you can stay with those feelings of whatever they are, fear going into terror, despair, sadness going into despair. And then you come out the other side at some point, and then you can do your lovely, healthy, creative, healing stuff. You know, it's not either or, is it?
I mean, Michelle had this when she was younger, in her 20s, I think, that she was afraid not to leave the house because she felt if she didn't do it every day, she would never leave. So it's like that, isn't it? You're afraid not to get out of bed and you'll never get out.
Yeah, in case that's right. Yeah.
But you know, realistically, that's not true. So then then you say, well, it's the loss of time and all these things, but it's not that either. So it really is just like the feeling that these feelings will swallow you up. They're somehow annihilating.
Yeah, my nightmare last night was about being, I forgot an awful lot of the story, but fortunately I woke up, which was the massive terror at the end. I had to wake up, and then finally I did, which was good because it meant that I remember at least the last bit of the dream.
Mm.
So I sat up for 10 minutes and just said it out loud so I didn't forget it, because I wanted to go fall asleep again. So the essence of it is that I'm in a dystopian world or a world where we've all been grabbed and ruled and imprisoned and robbed of any of our own, freedom, obviously, but anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Autonomy.
Yeah, and even worse, we're underground. There's like stairs or something. But I'm working on all women, loads of women. I'm trying to get away, and all these people, and then I find myself stuck in this, I don't know, cave of staircases and women, and one of them really loves me, and she keeps saying, but it's all right because we can do a little bit here and a little bit there. Maybe we could do a little bit of work over there. And I said, well, that's it, not no better, because that's underwater. I can't survive underwater. She said, but I love you. And I said, I know, but that's not enough. And so I fight to get away, and I managed to get out somehow. And I'm running, and I'm caught, and then I'm running again, and then I get through, and this is all not only underground, but you know, man-made underground, concretes and stuff, really, really ugly, confined, airless places, no nature, no life, and finally I get out. And I start to move up into the air, which Jung always said was a bad sign. But there are trees. It's like a tropical growth everywhere. It's beautiful, and water coming, you know, rain coming in, and all the greenery, and it's all really, really beautiful. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm free! And then the monsters, whoever they are, start to come in to get me. No, I'm never going to be free. And I scream, wake up, wake up, wake up. And finally I wake up.
What were the monsters then?
I don't know. They were the rulers of this existence that kept us caged and conditioned, and to do this work, which I had no idea. Well, the woman that loved me, she said there were ways that we could be a little bit helpful to others. So she was a very loving, good woman, except that she wouldn't fight her way out. To me, that wasn't good enough because we couldn't live. I didn't feel like I was alive, you see. And then when I got out, I was alive.
Mm. Yeah, that's probably how this world looks to Dave.
Yeah, and so when I was taught about it, when I was awake, I mean, as in the next morning, I thought, well, that it sounds like or feels like, looks like what you've been talking a lot about, Jason, you know, being imprisoned and well, you and Dave have been talking about a lot, haven't you, being imprisoned in this version of being alive, which is what we're in, right? And when I busted through and it was all gross and nature and air and sky and all that, actually, I don't remember the sky, but certainly air. And that's not a prison. But then I wasn't safe there either. So, but I wondered if, I mean, I'm absolutely useless at interpreting my own dreams, but I wondered if I'd broken out of the prison. And at least I'd found nature, but then maybe what I have to do if I'm going to get to this place of, well, you know what I'm talking about. I don't want to say if I'm going to get enlightened, because I don't want to sound like I think I'm going to get enlightened, because I don't think that, but I do feel it. I do feel, my God, is this what it is? Waking up.
Yeah, wake up. Why not that? If you're going to wake up from the nightmare.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone does eventually. Waking is inevitable. I mean, everyone, in quotes, whatever that means. Not people, but all the parts of the life force eventually have to be liberated. And with the nightmare analogy, I mean, we always wake up eventually. The nature of a nightmare is it does lead to awakening, unless you die of a heart attack in your sleep, I suppose. But it's a bit similar again, isn't it, to this, like if you use your will to get out of bed or to escape those feelings, they're going to follow you anywhere. Yeah, I mean, I say use your will, I'm not quite sure what I mean by that. I mean, we already have a sense of what I mean by that, probably, but I mean, it's use your will in a certain way. I'm not saying the will is necessarily a bad thing. The life force is kind of like will, I think, true will, perhaps. Ooh, that's a Crowleyan phrase. But anyway, there is a way. I mean, it's confusing because Dave's certainly encouraging us and trying to inspire us and empower us to break out of the prison, no doubt, that analogy. And yet at the same time, it's like, what's motivating, perhaps it's to do with what's motivating us to break out.
Yeah,
it seems like it's really confusing because he's used the analogy of, you know, how they used to try and get people enlightened, putting their head under water until they couldn't breathe, and then letting them up again, basically a form of torture, and then saying until you want enlightenment as desperately as you want air, then it's not going to happen. So
he said that.
Well, no, that's what they say when they did, when they would do that. He wasn't prescribing that method. He was just saying that there is there may be something in the idea that we need to want freedom as completely and utterly with all of our being, as if we needed air to breathe in order to really make the movement towards it. So that does indicate the power of desperation. And I've also felt that and expressed that many times. That,
yeah, that's what my dream was like.
Feel the acute pressure that we're under in order to respond to it and just take the leap. For some reason, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid came to mind. You know, I don't like that movie, but when they jump, right, they've got glass. Mm-hmm. You idiot, the fall will kill you. Doesn't matter if you can swim or not, you've got to be in a situation where, as Castaneda as well, there's nothing left to do but jump. So there is that. There is some element of sheer desperation, I think, that can inspire us with courage. But on the other hand, it seems as though the only thing that works is surrender. And so the leap we're taking is a leap of surrender, and it can't be about preference. I don't want to be in hell anymore. I want to be in heaven. It has to be, I'm in hell and I accept that I'm creating this hell, and that my refusal to accept hell or just, you know, the Chinese finger trap thing, like the more we try and get out of hell, the more it holds on to us, because we're not seeing that the hell that we're in is internally generated. And the only way to see that is to stay in it in such a way that, and to let go of our resistance to it in such a way we have the aha moment. The hell isn't outside, it's inside. Because that's the thing that you fear and I fear about dying into. We fear we're dying into our own unconscious. Yeah. The unprocessed stuff. So what was chasing in the dream, you didn't, it wasn't even identifiable.
No, it's whoever was keeping us enslaved and denied air and beauty, nature.
So the freedom was illusory in a certain sense. You got the relief, but
it's like, I don't know, those levels, wasn't it? It's like I got to the next level because it was, there's nature, but I still wasn't safe.
Song and it's all right. Maybe it's it's all right. And they can tell you what to do, but they'll make a fool of you, and it's all right. Baby, it's all right. There's a city in my mind. Come along and take that ride, and it's all right. Baby, it's all right.
Because nature isn't, that's the thing, nature is, it's not a paradise. If we had to go back to nature, it would be pretty hellish in a different way. Mm. And be sure of that. So it's not as though its beauty is to do with the fact it's real, not to do with the fact that it's full of good feeling and positive, you know, positive elements and whatnot. It's obviously, it's predatorial and violent and very hard to survive nature. I mean, one thing Dave has said that was quite important to me in this context, I think, was that he was quite content when he got enlightened.
Mm.
He was in a place in his life where he was quite happy already. Now, he's also said that he was always questing, and that only when he got enlightened did the quest end, and that questing was miserable. So it's, again, it's not either or. He still had this splinter that was driving him, because that was what was gone once he got enlightened. But at the same time, he found some sort of equilibrium in his life where anyway, and I also thought this may correspond with that psychological model that one needs a healthy ego to let go of the ego.
Mm.
For some reason I'm having an emotional response but around that.
You did?
Yeah, I was been quite moved.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, a healthy ego is one that's adapted and adjusted to reality, you could say, which is almost like no ego in itself, paradoxically. I mean, a healthy ego is one that's very non-reactive and flexible and sort of porous, but it's still there. And so it's not holding on and grasping and trying to make things happen. And then it lets go when... You know, when the time comes, it just lets go.
Mm.
That. So there's something about, it's mapping hell again. There's something about learning to be in hell and not have a reaction to it. Just like, oh hell, oh lack of autonomy, oh
hello hell,
depression, oh misery, torture, endless pain. This is reality, okay? Reality is good.
I can't imagine ever getting to that place, you see. I mean, of course, I've had moments of being in hell and I've survived it, but generally speaking, I don't feel like, in fact, I'm sure of this, I've not suffered the way Sebastian suffered. Probably not suffered as much as you did.
Well, I don't know. I don't really measure suffering. Certainly, he didn't suffer as loudly as Sebastian did, or as dramatically as I did. Or,
yeah, I mean, it's probably, it's definitely true. You can't really quantify it, but you can have a good sense of.
Anyway, but it's not about how much you're willing to suffer. I mean, the thing is about Jesus is, when I said this recently, I think it was the podcast with Chero, Poor Jesus. Oh, no, it was the thing I suggested you listen to, but not because I talk about hell in it, but because of Susie.
Yeah, I listened to that.
So, right, so you got, it was a bit of a Trojan horse. I realised after, so if I actually listen to this, he's going to have to hear all that stuff about hell. But anyway, I said, Poor Jesus, because I was thinking, when I was describing my experience of hell, I was realising, oh, this is what Jesus, you know, traditionally was doing. He was taking on the sins of the world. So he had been reliving, if you want to call it that, or just letting in all of the horrors, the human horrors, the horrors of the human heart. So yeah, of course that would be horrible. And by definition, there'd be an enormous amount of suffering involved, but it wouldn't be about that the suffering itself was redeeming. It would be about actually letting all of this stuff, bringing all this stuff to the light, letting the light come to it. Maybe that was the thing with the dream, is that you were fleeing hell to escape into light, when what really needs to happen is you need to let the light into hell. Let the light into that world. And that, I guess, only happens if it comes from us, like you with the old man. You just have to bring it into that space and transform it. And then, but in such a way that you don't get triggered and end up losing the little light that you had to give, right? Because that, obviously that would be impossible if Dave, or Jesus for that matter, was, and Chet and I talked about this, was just trying to spread the light indiscriminately in a way that didn't acknowledge our own limitations, then we'd end up, obviously we'd run out of transmission in no time. It just doesn't work like that. It's not like, I've got some transmission now, I'm going to share it. It's just about being completely open at all times, both to the source and to the world, which is heaven and hell, isn't it? We become the marriage between heaven and hell. And it's, I mean, you can see how that takes a Christ-like orientation, because can you bring heaven into hell if that means you're really always in hell indefinitely until hell is completely transformed? Basically, your whole time is in hell, but your connection is to heaven.
So that means, I mean, that plays out in a way that, say, let's take my life as an example, the way that I have moments of feeling heaven, joy, love, warmth, connection, loads of them. I mean, I feel this is sometimes what happens to me, or fairly often what happens to my thinking, probably much more than anything more. I don't know, let me finish the sentence and we see what we think. But so that I can't do this, I'm never going to get there, oh my god, I'm so frightened, I'm going to go to this dark hellish limbo, whatever. And then I think, well, yeah, but you're a pretty good person, and you've had loads of love in your life, so it's not that bad. Why are you going to this really negative, dismissive place? Why do I do that when you look at it, it's full of love and connections, relatively speaking, I mean. So I don't know, is what I'm asking myself, is that just the way I think, and I've just got to let go of that and just be and feel and be present? Does it encourage me, kind of, yes is the answer to this question, does it encourage me, yes, to think, oh well, you're not that bad, you can watch telly and eat cake, don't get too ambitious that you're going to be able to let go of all this, because you probably can't, because you're very, you know, attached to it all.
Oh, well, yeah, I think that's a problem in itself, isn't it? Because you can let go of it, and I can let go of it, so it's not about that. or even whether we will. It's about how much time we have and how much life force we have. So I think seeing addictions as addictions can be helpful up to a point, but then it becomes that other Chinese, another Chinese finger trap.
Yeah, so I don't feel like it's
missed. It does it in order to be naughty, actually thrives on thinking it's an addiction, because I'm going to indulge in my addiction and being fuck you. So yeah, it's about life force. And you know, it was ironic because I reckon, you know, we already brought this up, I suggested I would just go easy on yourself and watch some TV and have some snuggle time, and right after that Dave came out with both barrels, like, you know, being a stern father about doing those kinds of things. But you know, my sense there is that there is a part of us that's trapped, and we're trying to rescue it, and it doesn't want to be rescued, even though that's what it wants more than anything. Mm. So it does have to be pacified and placated, as well as just, it can't just be routed out of hell. Mm.
Mm.
So there is a kind of, this happens in therapy as well, whatever, when we're trying to help people, we've got, like Dave said, we've got to enter in the space that they're in and completely feel it in our bodies, and but not forget, not get lost in it, otherwise then we can't help them. It's like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, Svagito does that. He, in the therapeutic conversation, he'll go into the pain, and then when it gets so far, he'll bring it back with something really bright and real about the client.
Yeah.
And then if the client gets carried away with all that, he'll go back into the darkness.
Yeah. So there's parts of our body that are cut off and isolated, and there's no life force, and they are damned. They would feel damned, and it would feel damned. It would feel like part of us is damned. And that if part of us is down, then all of us is down, because we can't go to heaven until all of us is together. And then that's true of humanity. There are, as I wrote about Hitler, you know, there are parts of humanity, which is us, that seem, you know, unsavable. But if we can't save them, then all of us are stuck.
Yeah,
it's a real feeling.
That's so frightening, that, to me, because I just think, well, what the bloody hell's the point? See, and this, what's come up for me in the last few minutes, and it's been coming up for me again and again in the last few weeks, is Nick and Sebastian, but Nick's nihilism. I keep tapping into that, or feeling it, you know, it's come into me, or it is in me, whatever has happened, that this response I have sometimes, what's the point? Who cares? I mean, really. I don't actually say who cares, but I say, well, what's the point? There's no hope. There's no way. And it's, you know, it's just dark and it's over. And then I feel like I'm being Nick.
Mm. Yes. Well, that could be that would be a positive thing then, isn't it? Because you're holding a space for the father and for him to get rehabilitated. It's not Hitler. It's close.
Yeah, they merged when you got their birthdays merged.
Yeah, and our parents being wed on Hitler's birthday. I mean, come on. I'm sure they weren't conscious of it at the time, but still, it happened. There's something in that, and you know, whatever is our ancestral darkness, that's it, that's our Hitler, isn't it? And it probably does go as dark goes, because an ancestral line is very long, and now it's particularly dark. So
I know, and I feel, you know, Sebastian was so dramatic about his nihilism, or with his nihilism, or whatever, so larger than life and so massively visible and verbal and all of that. It was it doesn't really matter, what's the point? I mean, really, and just mutter and potter about, you know. So it doesn't show to people who don't know me.
No, that would make it, I mean, of course it would come out more with Sebastian and I, because then we've got the, you know, we've got to represent the whole family system. and I feel as though Dave was touching on that yesterday when he was asking, you know, who wants disease, darkness and depression, and he said, all Jason's people.
I went like that.
He might have to go there soon. I mean, he's been saying that for a while. Because, well, not because, but I'm bringing it up because it's this thing of the system needing to be in balance. Because so if certain people, certain areas aren't acknowledging the dark, then the dark comes up disproportionately in other parts, just in the body as well. Symptoms of the whole imbalance in the whole body comes out in certain areas, whether it's the liver or the lungs or the heart or the stomach, in Valerie's case.
Yeah.
And that's when you have a system that's really out of balance. It's terminal, it can become terminal. So yeah, I mean, if you get darker, I can get lighter, and vice versa. If I get lighter, you have to get darker. I suppose it would work that way.
Well, it's been like that a bit in the last few weeks, because you've been so optimistic and I've been so down. Then when I spend time with you, like I said the other day, my optimism comes back really easily, because it's you and me being close, and also because I've got so much innate optimism.
Well, we all have innate optimism. It's called life force.
Yeah. But to keep the relationship between the light and the dark.
Well, I mean, because I've always said optimism isn't about seeing things in a positive. It's not about seeing things as all positive. It's about being positive about how negative things are.
You're positive about how negative things are. Yeah, well, you're good at that, you see. You do seem to have the working relationship between the two.
Well, maybe.
Because you go so deep and dark, but then you also put a good spin. You don't exactly put a good spin on it, but you do embody, an energy around that.
Well, sure, but I mean, I've exemplified something, but again, it's probably over-exemplified. I keep, for my own harmonious functioning, I probably don't want to spend so much time with my Scorpio South Node. I want to be moving into Taurus North Node, the beauty, the harmony.
Yeah, I know. I want you to do that as well. Does that mean I have to then do the balancing out with the darkness?
Well, not necessarily, but we did just make that equation today. What are you doing down there with all that?
Oh, sorry, you can tell. I'm trying to find this thing that Emma wrote, because it's about this. Oh, here it is. And it's amazing. And I wrote back to her about it. We walked for hours, Matt and I, and found an enormous cemetery. Matt and I almost, but not quite, had an argument in the cemetery, because Matt didn't want to settle down because he said he felt on edge, and I just didn't get it, because I thought it's beautiful, it's deep, it's the best place possible to settle down. Matt said he was worried about people judging us or sitting on a grave. I said, okay then, let's go to the field. As we walked, I was just thinking, I don't get it, it's just a cemetery, it doesn't affect me, I just love it here, what's the big deal? But then when we got to the field, I was just so sad, I couldn't talk even, couldn't do yoga. Matt moved me into child's pose and then kept me there. Then he moved me onto downward dog, then brought me up. By the time I got up, I was weeping in my sunglasses. We talked about death, and then we played catch and raced across the field. Ended up being a beautiful day. Isn't that the most beautiful thing? It's making me cry just reading it again. But they've worked together like that, and there's life force and the sun that was all there with the death, overground with the underground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the anecdote describes what I was trying to articulate about the heaven and hell.
Yeah.
Being together, coexisting like that in life.
Yeah.
Just engagement in living.
Yeah. And I think it's sometimes we're often my so I somehow don't do that because Giles is dead and Sebastian's dead and they're over there and I'm over here. It's not that I don't stay in dialogue with Giles, as you know, and even, well, I don't know, I said even, and Sebastian. But I still have this huge divide. And
well, I mean, there's no bigger divide.
No, that's right, and so I can't work out why that's wrong, but it feels wrong when I read something like that. And it's not that I don't try and practice that, you know, I do.
Next generation, they got a big edge on us. I mean, fortunately, in this case, because there's we can see evolution in action there, as opposed to devolution and degeneration. But yeah, you would hope that your offspring, your progeny would be succeeding in any number of ways in which you have failed. The best case.
I know. It's so great being a mother when you have that. It's, oh, well, you know, I'm just such a failure in so many ways. But look, my daughter's, she's doing this. She is this.
Mm-hmm. Changes in the heart, change within the blood. There is the end of that podcast. Next week's podcast is with France Ruppert on the nature of trauma-based society. The 16 Maps of Hell campaign, the unravelling of Hollywood superculture, is proceeding, maybe not full steam ahead, maybe one-tenth steam currently after a wonderfully turbo-boosted first week. It's now not quite flatlined. There's a steady dribble of a couple of donations per day, which as long as that keeps up, then, well, we will make the target with time to spare, I imagine. We're at currently £4,708.36. Of course, that'll be different by the time you hear this. Fingers crossed. We're about 2,000 away then from the audiobook stretch goal, and it's something like 55 more option threes, and we'll be there. There's been something like 85. Contributors so far. My thanks to all of you, and if you want to continue to help us reach the finish line, then see if you can find one other person to contribute, and even if only half of you are successful, that alone should also get us to the designated goal. This is me at The Limitless, the podcast between adultyculture.com. Thanks everyone for your support. Strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion to the stars. Changes in the heart, change with the